facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A terrific Tuesday to you. So glad you're with me on the show. Call in 1-888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You could also reach us by email, trusty old email, cale@relevantradio.com, cale@relevantradio.com. It's a great place to send your questions. If you have questions about the faith, we do collect them. We do Ask Me Anything sessions every once in a while. We love to hear questions from listeners. You can also tweet at us at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. And I believe Lucas has his beverage of choice. I have mine. Let's crack him open. Okay. Lucas, what do you got today?
Cheers. Cheers. I have a Coke Zero, thanks to you, Cale.
Yes, the ones I left behind in Chicago. You're still working your way through that stash. That's good.
Yep, glad still working my way through them.
I'm glad you haven't drank them all in one sitting. I'm going to go with the Pepsi Zero Sugar because that's what I've got on hand. And let's raise a toast to the great Catholic writer Flannery O'Connor. And producer Lucas, I don't know if you know this, but today is the 58th anniversary of Flannery O'Connor's death. And she is obviously one of the most, if not the most, beloved American Catholic fiction writers of all time. And I was sick the day they taught math at school. So working my way back here, if it's the 58th anniversary of her death, what year did she pass away?
1964.
There you go.
I cheated and looked that up.
You had to Google it.
But I did have to Google it. You know what's funny, though? I have heard so much about Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. I have not read a single one of her books. So I'm really looking forward to this show because I'm going to learn a lot about her.
Well, it probably won't comfort the audience to know that I too, have not read a single one of Flannery O'Connor's book. So what on earth can we possibly have to say about her? Well, I have turned to an expert to tell you about her. And, you know, I'm actually surprised to hear that, Lucas, because you're big into Catholic fiction. You're a big Lord of the Rings guy, J.R.R. Tolkien. You're into that. We've talked about this a million times. I personally don't read much fiction anymore. I used to when I was younger, when I was a kid. I was totally into it. And it's not that I hate the idea of fiction. I mean, I watch movies, TV shows, but I must admit, I haven't read a novel in years. It's been way, way too long. And maybe I should go back to that because you can ascertain truth from stories for sure. And it can really help. But I tend to be more into reading about apologetics, explaining and defending the faith, about history, scripture, books like that. You know, did this stuff really happen? How do we know that? Here's why. That's really what I'm into. But so Flannery O'Connor, I must admit, is not somebody I've read either. And really the only thing I know about Flannery O'Connor from personal experience, we all know this line, this famous quote that is attributed to her. I think she was at a party of some sort and the topic of Catholicism came up. The topic of the Eucharist came up. And she is alleged to have said to her interlocutor, if I'm pronouncing that right, with respect to the Eucharist, quote, "If it's just a symbol, to heck with it," end of quote. If it's just a symbol, to heck with it. Now, she didn't say heck. She said something a little bit more strong, slightly more strong, but I don't want to be censored by the FCC, so I'm not going to say it. Nah, it's not that bad, but you know what I mean. So what is it about Flannery O'Connor that makes her stand out? Well, somebody who does know about Flannery O'Connor on this 58th anniversary of her death is the professor Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin. Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, and he's actually a writer and a professor of English at Hillsdale College. And he's a big devotee of Flannery O'Connor. And he wrote an interesting piece over at CWR on this day, on this anniversary of her death, of her passing. And it starts off like this. This is sort of the teaser for the article. "She gleefully maimed and killed off her characters in a million disturbing ways. Yet she was a devout daily mass attending Catholic, who read St. Thomas Aquinas in her spare time and made a pilgrimage to Lourdes." So she maimed and killed off her characters in a lot of disturbing ways. And this was all news to me. And reading the piece, I was shocked. But there's a reason why she shocked people with her stories, with her short stories, with her novels. And she didn't write many novels. She only wrote two novels, but she wrote 24 short stories that continue to shock people and unsettle them. And by the way, she died of terminal lupus, had a relatively short life. But Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, and I got to interject here too as well. I was going to start off the show by talking about the Shroud of Turin, and I'm going to talk about that later. That's what I wanted to talk about first, but I asked my wife, and Trish is really, really, she's a good judge of these things. I said, what should I start with? Should I start with the Flannery O'Connor story or start talking about the Shroud of Turin? And she said, go with Flannery O'Connor. It's pretty evocative. So you'll have to be the judge of this. But Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin said, quote, with a wicked pen, Flannery O'Connor gleefully maims, kills off her characters in disturbing ways. They get drowned. They get hanged. They're run over by cars twice in a row, wrapped in barbed wire, beaten to death. This sounds awful. This sounds awful. This is not the kind of stuff I would normally want to read. But if you read her biography, she is considered to be practically the patron saint of Catholic fiction. And as we mentioned off the top, she went to Mass every day, read Aquinas, went to the Shrine of Our Lady of Lourdes in France. So how can we square these two things, her brutal, violent fiction and her devout Catholic point of view? Well, here's what Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin says. Here's how you reconcile all this. All of her stories follow one basic narrative, and it's from the Bible. It's really the story of St. Paul on the road to Damascus. You know, his great conversion story, we can read about that in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 9. Also, Paul tells his conversion story three times in the Acts of the Apostles. So that's really important. You don't waste parchment in the ancient world. If he's hiring a scribe to write this, you don't put your conversion story in three times unless you really, really want people to know all about it and how important that was to Paul. Well, that's really what the writing of Flannery O'Connor is all about. And if you want to call in 1-888-914-9149 on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, if you've read Flannery O'Connor, which I haven't, what's your favorite work of hers? Why do you recommend that? Or really, what's your favorite Catholic fiction book and why? Well, who's your favorite Catholic fiction writer? If it's not O'Connor, who is it? Give me a call. Let me know. 1-888-914-9149. So O'Connor really has this basic theme in all of her stories, St. Paul on the road to Damascus. So what it's all about is really an act of violence, incredible violence, followed by divine grace, shocking a hard-hearted, a wicked person, a selfish person, and in that moment, they realize God. So it's very, very much is a parallel to St. Paul's life. Searing violence, an event of searing violence, such as the murder of St. Stephen, the first Christian martyr. And St. Paul, of course, participated in that. He was holding the jacket, so he was an accomplice to murder. The guys who were killing Stephen, stoning him to death. I always think it's really interesting that the feast day of St. Stephen is the day after Christmas. You know, after all the celebrations, we're reminded there is a cost to Christianity. This could cost you your life. It's a little bit like getting the credit card bill after Christmas. There is a cost to all of this. Is it worth it? Yes, but it's going to cost you everything. So Paul on the road to Damascus. So after the murder of St. Stephen, after all that, he's rounding up more Christians, throwing them into prison. Jesus meets him on the Damascus road, the risen Jesus, the glorified Jesus in heaven, that blazing light that's shown all around. And that's really what Christ does with our lives. He illuminates all of our life. And when we're converted, we see that the light of Christ, there's no part of our life that it doesn't shine into. And so this is really what Flannery O'Connor tries to get across too, with her characters in her stories, according to Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, that eventually her characters have this kind of epiphany, this moment that they encounter God, and all of their illusions about life, the way they thought it was, what they thought it was all about, it all gets burned away. And so apparently one of her most famous stories is called Good Country People. Good Country People. And this sounds quite wild. It's a story of a woman named Holga, who is a nihilist. You know, she's an atheist. She has a PhD in philosophy. She also has a wooden leg. This is Holga in the story Good Country People by Flannery O'Connor. So she's convinced that life is meaningless, morality means nothing, and she lives absolutely consumed by pride and anger until, and this is where things get a little bit sordid here, she meets a traveling Bible salesman who seduces her and steals her wooden leg. I can't believe it. So she's left stranded. Holga is left stranded. She has only one leg. She's in the loft of a barn. And as the salesman is leaving, he's going down the ladder. He says to her, "You ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born." End of quote. So Holga is absolutely horrified to meet somebody who actually is an atheist. In other words, atheistic philosophy, this is how he actually lives his life. He actually lives out the philosophy that she claims to believe, atheism. So this is what it looks like in practicality. In real life, if you actually were an atheist, if you actually behaved as if God didn't exist, these are the sorts of things that you would do. So as the story ends, Holga apparently faces a pivotal choice. What am I going to do now? Do I accept this is, in fact, the true outworking of my philosophy? Do I really want to continue on as an atheist, or do I want to maybe turn to God? So this is interesting. So I haven't read the story, but this is described by Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin in his article in the Catholic World Report. So really what it's all about is the true face of evil. So this is what O'Connor tries to do, apparently, in her books and her writings, to reveal the true face of evil. Now, why would she want to do that? Why would she want to do that? Well, apparently, it's because she knew that we were living in this age of relativism. You know what that's all about, this idea that there is no such thing as truth. There's his truth, her truth, their truth. There's no such thing as absolute truth. Now, of course, the great irony is that is a truth statement when you say there is no truth. There is no absolute truth. People think that's true who believe that. And Pope Benedict XVI, he wrote a lot about this. He called it the dictatorship of relativism. We are living in the dictatorship of relativism. You have to believe that to get along in society today. So Flannery O'Connor apparently realized that we're on the cusp of and this is, you know, decades ago, but she realized that we're on the cusp of an age of relativism. We've lost the sense of right and wrong, the ability to distinguish between good and evil. And here's what she wrote in an essay. Quote, this is Flannery O'Connor here. She said, "When you can assume that your audience holds the same beliefs that you do, you can relax a little bit and you can use more normal means of talking to it. But when you have to assume that your audience does not hold the same beliefs that you do, then you have to make your vision apparent by shock." By shock. So this is why she shocked people with these outlandish depictions of violence and just wacky figures in her stories. And she said this, "To the hard of hearing, you shout, and for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures." So if you've got somebody that can't hear you almost have to shout to get their attention. "Can you hear me?" And with someone who's blind, you have to exaggerate what you're drawing so that they can see. And this is really what she did in her stories. She was trying to use this outlandish stuff to make a bigger point about the nature of good and evil. I find this utterly fascinating. We're going to go to the phones right now. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149, talking about the anniversary. Today is the 58th anniversary of Flannery O'Connor's death. We're going to go to David now in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Yes, I am a writer, and I grew up reading some of Flannery O'Connor, mm-hmm. and I was instructed in a writing class from a literacy center to read Flannery O'Connor. And I read one story in particular called The Misfit.
Okay.
And very graphic details, very shocking graphic details for the times. It was written in the 50s or 60s, and almost a horror story, almost, with the mm-hmm. murder in the story.
Okay.
And you say she's Catholic and religious. I don't see so much of that in that story, but
okay.
Of course, it's fiction, you know.
Right. So it's almost too much for you. It's almost way over the top, and you question whether or not her beliefs.
Well, I was a lot younger back then, and it kind of shocked me a little bit. But some murder in the story, and I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't quite like the shock value of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, David. As David calling from Lexington, Kentucky. And yeah, that's a sense I'm getting too. That I didn't realize. I'll freely admit, I did not realize what her writings were really all about. This is not for the faint of heart. And so this article that I was reading, and this was in the Catholic World Report by Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, who is a professor. He's a professor of English at Hillsdale College. He's a writer, so he's intimately familiar with O'Connor and what she was trying to do. Now, he says this in his article, and I quote, "In a Western culture that accepts sin as personal preference and dismisses moral truth claims as ideology or bigotry." And how often, maybe this has happened to you, you say, well, I believe in an absolute moral law. Oh, you're a bigot. Maybe that's happened to you. So he goes on to say, "Modern man needs an arresting, visceral description of evil that can shock everyone into agreeing this is wrong." That's pretty thought-provoking. I remember having a discussion about this with somebody at a wedding. I remember this is like late at night. It was kind of an outdoor wedding party. It was in the middle of the summer. I was sitting around the fire with some of the guests. I never met these guys before, but one guy, we started talking about, I don't know how we got onto this topic of morality. And I was using the argument that C.S. Lewis uses in Mere Christianity. We've talked about this recently on the program. Right and wrong is a clue to the meaning of the universe, that pretty much everybody agrees that there is such a thing as right and wrong. If you try to cheat somebody, they'll say, oh, that's not fair. Well, what are you basing that on? You're basing that on some moral principle that's beyond the two of you, that's over and above you, that has authority, this moral law in the universe. And people appeal to this all the time. That's not fair. That's wrong. And people will draw the line in different places in terms of what's right and what's wrong. Maybe depending on what they're into, with their favorite, you know, if they like to practice a certain thing that the church calls sinful, they'll say, well, it's not wrong to me. But at some point, everybody has to draw the line somewhere. And so maybe that's, you know, the horrific example of a gunman going into a school and mowing down a bunch of innocent children. But almost everybody would say, who's sane, would say that is wrong. And maybe that's what Flannery O'Connor was trying to do. She was trying to give extreme examples to shock people into saying, yeah, there must be a moral law in the universe. So I don't know what you think about that. But if you have any takes on that, you can call me 1-888-914-9149. I'm going to go back to the phones right now. Margaret is calling from Campbell, California. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Cale. I don't have much time. I'm out in front of an appointment.
Oh, so sure.
But I've got to go in. So I just wanted to say that my an author that I really enjoyed, a Catholic author, was Lucy Beckett.
Lucy
she wrote
Beckett.
a postcard from the volcano about just before World War and during World War II in Germany, and then kind of a sequel, The Leaves Are Falling, and you know, part of it's in the concentration camps, but it's about four young college students, university students, and one of them's Jewish, and then all that's happening, you know, at the beginning before the war starts. Anyway, she's a very good writer.
Okay, well, thank you for mentioning that, Margaret. I have not heard of Lucy Beckett. Producer Lucas, have you heard of Lucy? Or
I have not.
Okay, no. So Margaret, thank you for alerting us to that. And I appreciate that. It's something to check out. And good luck with your appointment. I hope it goes well, whatever it may be.
Kind of a historical novel. And so it's a good book to read, you know. I got to go. Thank you.
Okay, good luck in your appointment. Thanks for taking the time to call. That was Margaret calling from Campbell, California. And yeah, a good historical novel will be a learning experience, too, if the writer has really done their homework. Really knows the era that they're talking about. You can actually pick up a lot of facts from these fictional stories as well. And so when it comes to Flannery O'Connor, really, her writings do help to answer the question of, and really, this is maybe the only great argument that atheists have in their arsenal, is the problem of evil. The fact that evil does exist in the world, does that somehow disprove the existence of God? And Flannery O'Connor went over the top in her depictions of evil in her books. How does this help us to understand why a good God will allow such things in the world? We're going to talk about that right after this break. 1-888-914-9149. Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. It's the Cale Clark Show on this Tuesday, August the 3rd, and it's the 58th anniversary of the passing of Flannery O'Connor, the famous American Catholic writer, fiction writer who died on this day in 1964. And just before the break, we were talking about how her writings really deal with the problem of evil at a certain level. And there's a caller who called in, didn't want to come on the air, but left this comment with us. And I'm not sure who this person was, what his or her name was, but the comment was, I've read Flannery O'Connor. I'm 68 years old. I just read her short stories and I end up having nightmares. Don't read it before going to bed. They are frightening, but I understand what Flannery is trying to say. End of quote. All right. So there you have it. It's not bedtime reading. And this article by Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin, we've kind of tagged it on our show account on Twitter. Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin writes, we can see a deeper truth behind O'Connor's terrific fictional violence. She wants to show us the way. He's not saying the violence is terrific. Oh, I love this. It's a lot. It's terrific in terms of its quantity. She wants to show us the way that divine providence can bring good even out of terrible evil. To many of us, the problem of evil remains perhaps the most compelling argument against the existence of a loving and all-powerful God. But O'Connor answers this by showing how God actually incorporates the violent sins of people into his plan. End of quote. God sort of factors that in. That's an interesting thought. And on yesterday's program, if you missed it, you can always check the podcast on relevantradio.com or through the app. We talked about this whole issue a lot. We had a lot of callers call in who had experienced a lot of distress in their life. And this verse, obviously, of St. Paul's letter to the Romans, Romans 8:28, how God makes all things, even the bad things, work together for the good of those who love God. That takes a lot of faith. And apparently in O'Connor's novel, Wise Blood, there's a character named Hazel Motes, who's an atheist, and actually an atheist preacher, an atheist preacher from the quote-unquote church without Christ. So this is a character in her novel, obviously not real, but Hazel Motes, this atheist preacher, runs over with her car a rival prophet named Solace Layfield. Hazel Motes is a guy, apparently. So Hazel Motes, with his car, runs over a rival prophet named Solace Layfield. So you can tell I've never actually read the story, which I haven't. I haven't read anything personally by O'Connor, but I find this fascinating. So Solace Layfield, apparently, as he's laying dying in the street, he was only pretending to be a rival atheist prophet. He was only pretending to be a false prophet simply to make money on street corners. And in his process of dying there on the street, he's dying in his own blood. He actually confesses his sins and calls out to Jesus. So just moments after working as a false prophet for $3 a night, he gets a wake-up call, the ultimate wake-up call, and he responds to God's grace. And Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin says, well, little wonder that Flannery O'Connor named this character Solace. Solace. So he says that what she does in her writings is she allows acts of violence to exist because God uses those things to bring spiritual healing in wounded and sinful characters. Not that God causes people to do violent things, but God can use anything to his advantage, even sin. And Flannery O'Connor believed that violent encounters stripped away the non-essential and make us confront the truth of things. She said to an audience once, quote, "It is the extreme situation that best reveals what we are essentially. The man in the violent situation reveals those qualities least dispensable to his personality, the qualities which are all he will have to take into eternity with him. And since the characters in the story are all on the verge of eternity, it's appropriate to think of what they take with them." Okay, that sounds pretty dark. I mean, it sounds almost like what the Joker said in The Dark Knight. You know, I use a knife because you find out who people really are, you know. Okay, that's super dark. We don't want to go there. We don't want to go down that road. But basically her point was, when you're about to die, your priorities are pretty clear about who you are, and what you really believe comes into focus pretty quickly. And the payoff of all of this, if there is a positive payoff, and I think there is, Kelly Scott Franklin says, the events in O'Connor's fiction should remind us that God actually brought about the redemption of all human beings precisely through permitting, allowing an act of unspeakable violence to happen, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The crucifixion of Jesus Christ. That's a powerful point, that God basically allowed human beings to kill his son. And if God can bring cosmic victory out of this allegedly and apparently senseless torture, the execution of the innocent Jesus, then it's possible that in our lives he can also make all things work together unto good. So that's what she tried to do. This is very vivid. This is very shocking in a lot of ways. And I had no idea that O'Connor was like this. I obviously haven't read her writing myself, but as Dr. Kelly Scott Franklin says, buckle up. If you do read Flannery O'Connor's works, it's going to be pretty intense, but the life you save may be your own. So, wow, that was a powerful article. We're going to go now to the phones. Joan is calling from Reiner, Virginia. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Hello?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can.
Okay, great.
I'm sorry.
You're live on the air.
I'm glad to hear you recognizing Flannery O'Connor. A lot of people, haven't read her works. Mm-hmm. I was first introduced to her in my 50s when I started working for a public department of welfare, and I was working with adult and child abuse cases.
Oh.
And so Flannery's stories were shocking, but some things rang true. And I did have a chance to visit her girlhood home in Savannah, and it was very close to the church that she went to, which her faith was such an important part of her life. And so I picked up a bumper sticker when I was there, and it said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd." And I think that just fits her to a T, and I think of that often when I see things in life, and I feel like I'm so out of touch with what everybody else thinks about it.
Well, that's an important point, that the truth shall make you odd. I think that's pretty funny. And really, St. Paul talks about this in the New Testament, that, you know, oftentimes we're fools for Christ. You know, the world looks at us as fools for believing the gospel. We don't fit in a lot of ways, but that's okay, because not everybody's going to love the truth. And we see what happened to our Lord, right? And so, but the truth does set us free. That's another thing that Jesus said. The truth not only makes us odd, but it also sets us free, because that's reality. Joan, thank you very much for your call. That was Joan calling from Reiner, Virginia. We're going to go now to Leslie, who's in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I want to say I'm so glad that you listened to your wife and that you put this topic on. I think that the shroud is so, so important, but we hear about that often, and I don't hear enough about Flannery O'Connor. And just like you, and I have not read any of her books, but I have been amazed by things that have been said about her and her books, her work. And I just love, you know, the truth will make you odd. I feel like a misfit so many times myself. But what just listening to this has made me realize that I want to get off my duff and write a book. I've had it in the making for a while, and I just know that it has to be edgy enough because it's going to be for children. And so it has to be edgy enough that they will look back and think, what does this really mean? And hopefully find the truth. And that will be my big challenge. Maybe that's why I haven't written it yet.
But it's like it, sort of a young adult fiction type thing? Or?
Well, it might end up to be young adult fiction. And that's another thing. I always read things for school and then for church and this. And so I haven't read that much fiction either. But I do think that it's important to grab people's attention by fiction. And I think that's hard to do now in a culture of movies what's going on with, you know, the internet and everything, that people will actually sit down and read a fiction. So mine is more like stories for children that bring out virtue.
That's so important. Well, hey, best of luck with that, Leslie. And yeah, maybe God has nudged you towards writing that book, you know, by hearing about Flannery O'Connor. And yeah, I agree. In this day and age, it takes a lot to grab people's attention because there's so many things vying for our attention and so many wonderful bells and whistles on our smartphones and on our screens. How do we get people back to reading in general? And it'd be great if they could read the book, the Bible, Biblios, right, which means book in Greek. And yeah, that's where the truth is really going to be found. And the truth is much stranger than fiction. And the truth is what's going to set us free and what's going to make us odd. And certainly Flannery O'Connor. Just reading an article about her books makes me want to read her books. Wow, such arresting imagery in her life. So Leslie, thanks for that call. That was Leslie calling from Tampa, Florida. Lucas, can we take a quick break here? Okay, we're going to take a really fast break here. So hang with me, because when we come back on the other side, I am going to talk about the Shroud. I'm going to tell you about the first guy who photographed the Shroud ever. And what he had to say about this. So we're gonna be right back. You are not gonna want to miss this. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. Be right back.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. Yeah, and just talking about Flannery O'Connor and her depictions of violence and how even the worst that humanity can bring, God can flip that around and God can turn that for good. And no bigger example of that is the unspeakable violence of the cross and how God brought about the greatest good from that, our salvation. And speaking of that unspeakable violence, we really see this displayed in the Shroud of Turin. And I'm often asked, Cale, I give a lot of talks on this, on the resurrection, on the Easter event, and people often ask me, Cale, do you think that the Shroud of Turin is legit? Do you think it's real? I do think it is. I really do. I know it's disputed by some. I do think the Shroud is the real deal. However, I almost never talk about it in public, because when I'm giving talks on it, we don't need the Shroud of Turin to be an actual relic of the cross and the burial of Jesus Christ for the purposes of proving the resurrection, that he rose from the dead. And if you listen to our sister program, The Faith Explained, this week, you're going to hear a lot of great evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And we're going through chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, that great chapter, maybe the most crucial chapter in the entire New Testament, the earliest references in the New Testament to the resurrection appearances of Christ. What does it all mean? So we don't need the Shroud to be real to prove the resurrection. We've got a lot of evidence already on our side. But if it is real, if it is an actual relic from the Passion, then so much the better. And I do think there is really good evidence for it. And one person who knows a lot about the Shroud, a lot more than most people, is Barry Schwartz. Barry Schwartz, and his name is spelled B-A-R-R-I-E, Schwartz, S-C-H-W-O-R-T-Z. Now, Barry Schwartz runs the website shroud.org, which is really one of the best websites, if not the best website in the world, about the Shroud of Turin. So you're going to want to check that out. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And you might recall that back in 2015, Pope Francis made a pilgrimage to Turin, Italy. And that's, of course, where the Shroud is located. And he not only visited the Shroud, but he also visited the tomb of Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, who, and we've talked about him, time permitting, we'll say a little bit more about him later. If not, maybe we can do it tomorrow. But Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, Lucas and I were talking about him the other day. Such an inspiring saint for today. He was from Turin, and he's buried in a nearby altar, very, very close to where the Shroud is housed. And also, by the way, St. John Bosco, who's a patron saint of youth, really important saint in the history of the church, he also worked in Turin. Now, Barry Schwartz, he has never said this publicly, and I have no inside information on this, but I have a funny feeling. I've seen this guy interviewed before in the press, and I have a funny feeling that, now he comes from a Jewish background, sort of a secular Jew, a non-practicing Jewish background. I have a funny feeling that he is really, really close to belief in Jesus Christ because of the Shroud. Now, I can't prove that. Maybe I'll have to have Barry on the show one day. But he gave an interview not long ago to Jim Graves about the Shroud of Turin. And this is also in CWR. And he sort of lays out some of the most compelling arguments that the Shroud is, in fact, legit, that it is, in fact, the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. By the way, just so you get some sense of the dimensions of the Shroud, it's a 14 by 5 foot by 3.5 foot linen cloth. So it's linen. It's been kept in Turin since the year 1578. And Barry Schwartz was the photographer for the technical team of scientists that really had the first ever in-depth examination of the Shroud. And that was known as the Shroud of Turin Research Project. And this happened in 1978. And he really didn't want to be a part of this project, but he agreed to do it. And he was fully expecting, Barry Schwartz, that the Shroud would be proved to be a medieval fake. And there's plenty of people out there who still say that it is today. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. Well, his opinion has changed quite a bit since those days back in the late 1970s when he first looked at the Shroud and took photographs of it. And in the interview, Barry Schwartz said that when he went to Italy to first examine the Shroud, he thought it was a medieval painting. That was his theory. And he said after 10 minutes of looking at it and taking pictures of it, he said, I knew it wasn't a painting because there was absolutely no paint on this thing. There was no brush strokes. And for an additional 17 years, he refused to think that the Shroud was legit, that it was authentic. There was really one argument that got him in the end, and it was the blood on the Shroud. So what's interesting about the Shroud of Turin is that the blood of this person, whoever it may be, and it's very, very likely that it was Jesus, the blood is very red on the Shroud. Now, if you know anything about blood on a cloth, even just after a few hours, that blood is going to turn brown or black in appearance. But on the Shroud, it's still red. And Barry Schwartz said that he had a conversation with a blood chemist about this. And this guy's name was Alan Adler. And they were talking on the phone. He was sharing about his reservations of the Shroud, Barry Schwartz. And this blood chemist, Alan Adler, got really, really upset. And he said, Barry, did you not read my paper on this? I wrote a whole scientific paper on this. And what he'd found is that these blood drops on the Shroud had a high content of bilirubin. Now, producer Lucas, do you know what bilirubin is?
Someone's name, it sounds like.
Well, it's funny that you said that because my brother-in-law, Mike, he always wanted to start a band called Bilirubin and the Spleen Machines. So bilirubin actually, I guess, comes from your spleen.
Okay.
And there's a high content of bilirubin on the blood in the Shroud. And that explains why it's red. Because guess what happens? When someone is beaten, and they've gone through this physical you know, affliction of being beaten severely, and they're dehydrated. There's not enough water in their system. The body can go into shock. And the liver starts, apparently it's not your spleen, the liver starts pumping out bilirubin. And that's what makes the blood stay red forever. That's fascinating. And so for Barry Schwartz, that was really the last piece of the puzzle. He had really, that was the last answer to all of his questions. You know, why was the blood still red? Well, when a man is beaten and he said no water, his body goes into shock, the liver starts pumping out bilirubin, and that's what makes the blood stay red forever. And that's why the blood is red on the shroud. That is very consistent with what we know of the passion of Jesus Christ. And so, now that's only one piece of the evidence. You might say, oh, hang on here, that's only one piece of the evidence. That's true. There's a lot of other reasons why we might believe that the shroud is authentic. I had read, and I was trying to find the citation for this, but that in the image on the shroud, around the feet, they had found pollen in the cloth that was native to Israel at that time, and it was only found in the region where Jesus was crucified. That's a fascinating point. That's a fascinating point. Now, some people say, well, some people argue that the shroud is a medieval fake. They want to say that there's some parts of the cloth that have been dated to the Middle Ages. That's because the shroud was in a fire at one point, and they kind of tried to make it whole again by sort of adding some cloth on the ends around the image. Those are the parts of the shroud that are dated to the medieval period. But the actual image itself is from a first century piece of cloth. And you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149, talking about the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. And Barry Schwartz, who was the official photographer of the scientific team examining the shroud in the late 1970s, he actually says that one of his favorite testimonies to the authenticity of the shroud comes from his mother. And what does she know about this? Well, she was actually from Poland. She only had a high school level of education, and she actually went to one of the lectures that Barry Schwartz gives about the shroud. And as they were driving home afterwards, he and his mom, he said she was really quiet for a long time. And he says, you really have to worry. When a Jewish mother is quiet for that long, you have to ask, uh-oh, what's going on here? So he asked her, hey, Mom, what did you think of my talk? And she said, Barry, of course the shroud is authentic. They wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years if it wasn't. Now, on the surface of things, that doesn't sound like a great argument. Of course it's authentic. They wouldn't have kept it around for 2,000 years if it wasn't real. Now, okay, well, why would you say that? Well, because according to Jewish law, if you have a blood-soaked shroud, there is no way you're taking that out of a grave. There's no way, because that would be considered to be unclean. This would be not kosher, to say the least. You would not remove it from a grave. You would have been putting yourself at risk by violating Jewish laws about burial. Now, the only reason you would remove a blood-stained shroud from a tomb is if maybe the body isn't there anymore. Maybe the body isn't there anymore. That's an interesting explanation. So here's some falsehoods, some false teachings about the shroud that are often out there. Here's an interesting one that Barry Schwartz mentions, and I hadn't heard this. Some folks who try to debunk the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin, they say that a medieval artist created the image on the shroud. This is really extremely bizarre. This is something out of a Flannery O'Connor. It's so bizarre. That a medieval artist allegedly created it by using three different photographic exposures and his own urine. Oh, that sounds really gross. So Barry Schwartz calls that the shroud of urine theory. Okay. Very funny. And he says, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would somebody go to all that trouble when they simply could have painted an image? If you're trying to make a fake, that seems pretty complex. So That's to be ruled out, I think, here. Now, one of the things that we look at when we see the shroud, and you can look up images of the shroud, of course, online. You can search for Google images on the Shroud of Turin. You can also go to Barry Schwartz's website, www.shroud.com. I guess the triple W is kind of superfluous. Nobody does it anymore. Just say shroud.com. Anyways, what does the shroud actually tell us? If it is the burial cloth of Jesus, what can it tell us about the actual sufferings of Christ? Well, Barry Schwartz says that he's a fan of boxing. He loves boxing. And when he looks at the image of the face of the man on the shroud, he was obviously, whoever this was severely beaten. And particularly, you can note the swelling around the eyes. It's like you've been in a prize fight with Rocky Balboa. The facial image on the shroud, according to Schwartz, reminds me of a boxer who's just lost, you know, in devastating fashion. The back of this figure. Now, you can clearly see not only the wounds on the back of the body, but the front of the body. And that seems to indicate that this person who had been scourged, he's got all the marks of someone who's been scourged. It seems as if the thongs of what's called the flagellum, and this is the instrument, it's a whip with multiple thongs of leather on it. The Romans used this for the flogging before the crucifixion with their victims. It's also known as the cat of nine tails, and they would put pieces of bone, glass, metal on the leather thong, so that it's one thing to be whipped by this device, but the pullback is even worse because it literally rips open the flesh. And so this person on the shroud, it seems as if the thongs of the whip had wrapped around the body and hit the front as well. And this reminds me a lot of what we saw in The Passion of the Christ. Obviously, the hardest scene to watch in that movie, if you've seen it, is the flogging of Jesus, the scourging at the pillar. And Mel Gibson, the director of that film, said, you know, I wanted the audience to have to suffer. And you certainly do when you watch that. And a lot of people thought Mel Gibson was going way over the top on this. I don't think so. I think it's very historically accurate when you read about Roman crucifixions. The person on the shroud has a spear wound on his side. His legs are not broken. And typically, they would break the legs of a crucified person if they want to speed up his death. Not the case with the person on the shroud. We know that Jesus' legs were not broken when you read the Gospels. His head, his scalp are covered in wounds. And again, when we think about art, we think about the crown of thorns, and it's almost like a circle around the head, almost like a victor's crown at the Olympics, you know, laurel leaves or something like that. But that's actually not what the crown of thorns was all about. Barry Schwartz says the soldiers probably actually took part of a thorn bush and smashed it down on Jesus' head. In other words, it was like a cap covering the entire head. And we see wounds on the top of the head, the person who is depicted on the shroud. And also you see that where the nails were driven in, it's not through the center of the palm, it's through the wrist. It's closer to the wrist. And of course, there's that natural opening in the bones of the forearm close to the wrist, and that's a perfect spot for an iron spike to go through. If you try to nail somebody to a cross through their palms, the person would actually fall off the cross. It's not enough to hold the weight. The nail would rip right through the hand. But if you want to use ropes, and some crucifixions did, yes, that would work. But it's highly likely that the bones actually, the nails went through the wrist opening. But that's still, the wrist is considered part of the hand, so that's not a problem for us theologically. Makes sense. The feet, it's crucifixion victims, very common that their feet were nailed, maybe not with one spike, but with two, maybe 1 foot to each side of the cross. We don't know the actual details, but it's hard to tell from the shroud whether a single nail held both feet of this person or whether there was a nail driven into each one. But having said that, this is exactly the Roman methodology of doing this. So is this Jesus? This is very consistent with what we know from the Gospels, the wounds of the Passion, the sufferings of the Christ. We just don't know how the image, nobody can explain, science cannot explain to this day how this image got on the shroud. The head of UCLA, at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA Medical School, the head radiologist used to say that the image was a radioactive scorch. Now, Barry Schwartz says that's not the case. I don't know why he says that. He didn't really explain this in the interview, but that always seemed to me to be a plausible explanation. How did this image get on the cloth? Well, when Jesus was resurrected, so much energy was given off, it almost like burned the image of his body onto the cloth. That was always my theory, but Schwartz says no, which is very interesting to me that he says it's not a radioactive scorch. But we also know it's not a photograph and it's not a painting. It's really the most unique object of its kind in the world. And it's just full of mystery. And the secrets of the shroud, you know, we may never really understand exactly how that image got on the cloth until we're on the other side. And so the mystery is something we're going to have to live with. And there's certainly a lot of mystery in the writings of Flannery O'Connor. And today's the anniversary of her death in 1964. We talked about her earlier. So lots of interesting topics today on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. But we'll have much, much more for you tomorrow. So thankful that you joined me today. Lucas Holt produced. He's still working his way through the gifts of Coke Zero, the cans that I gifted him on my trip to Chicago last week, the Relevant Radio studio. So drink up, Lucas. Patrick Alog was that friendly voice on the other end of the phone. Took your phone calls. We'll be back with much, much more tomorrow on the Cale Clark Show, and I can't wait to join you then. Hey, if you missed an episode, you can always catch the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, share us. Get them on the Relevant Radio app and also on relevantradio.com. Until tomorrow, I'm Cale Clark. Thanks for joining me today. Thanks for taking the time. Great to spend the hour with you. Take it away, Michaela.